This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Smoke-filled rooms, shadowy alleys, black and white crime scenes, all markers of a period in cinematography known as film noir. Comprised mainly of films from the 40s and 50s, film noir features highly stylized characters and sets, dramatic plot lines, and lots of mystery. Joining us again for Movies on the Radio, Laura Boys, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. And the museum, by the way, hosting a series on unreliable men of film noir. Welcome back, Laura. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
Film noir. So what do we say about film noir? First of all, how good is that definition and what more do we need to know? Let me start with you, Marcia, about film noir. What else was it?
Yeah, well, obviously, based on the French term for it, it refers to a kind of dark film. And that's both in aesthetics and also in terms of content. So you get a lot of very cynical crime, adultery, people doing terrible things to each other, justice not being served, alienation and violence and paranoia. And then you also get a lot of visual darkness. By and large, these are certainly in the 1940s and 1950s. These are black and white films with a lot of really high contrast, often very beautiful cinematography, a lot of shadows, a lot of scenes taking place at night, so it's visually dark and thematically dark.
And when did this happen?
Well, after World War II, the reason that it gets a French name, film noir, is that a number of French writers and critics all of a sudden got a whole bunch of American movies all at once that they hadn't been able to see during World War II. And they saw that there were not only visual similarities, but thematic similarities between all of these films. And they kind of reflect a national post-traumatic stress disorder, that after World War II, men came home unsure of how to reintegrate into society. And the women were in a position where they were saying, oh, well, you did a great job in the factory. Okay, now go home and make a casserole. So there was a lot of anxiety about these kinds of gender roles.
Yeah, and as Laura is intimating, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about film noir is, unlike, say, the musical, which we did our last show on, where somebody would say, let's make a musical, nobody in America in the 1940s was saying, let's make a film noir. This is just kind of a spontaneous occurrence, you know, that has to do with certain kinds of things happening in the culture at the time, and it's certainly why we get these femme fatale characters that are so bad and are the downfall, you know, of these male characters. A lot of them take place in cities, some in the country, but usually it's people who are, you know, on the lam from the law. I also think that the writing for film noir is so important because there tends to be very crisp, snappy dialogue with lots of sexual innuendo and things like that.
And amoral behavior. I think that's kind of another element of that runs through these films, wouldn't you say?
And I think a lot of that is because many of them were what used to be called B movies, which meant that they were not the studio's prestige productions. So people were not following the thematic material as carefully. They didn't get the same kind of scrutiny because they honestly thought no one would ever see them. And the fact that some of these films are memorized line by line would have astonished the makers, who looked at them as cheap films and completely disposable.
And still popular today, let's listen to one of our callers who chose the 1944 film Double Indemnity.
My name's Tim Kirkman, and the first time I ever saw Double Indemnity, I remember liking it from the start, but when I fell in love with it was that famous scene where Fred McMurray meets Barbara Stanwyck for the very first time, and I remember how excited I was and how in awe I was of the way that the dialogue escalates into this hilarious and sexy, perfectly pitched moment between these two strangers. And I remember I watched it over and over again, studying the architecture of this, the dialogue and the scene. To my mind, it has the most perfect end to any scene in the history of cinema.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it. 8:30 tomorrow evening, then.
That's what I suggested.
Would You'll be here too?
I guess so. I usually am.
Same chair, same perfume, same anklet.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
There you go.
Oh, it's just, it's brilliant. And that's love great. That it goes on and on so much longer than you would ever expect to. And what you don't, of course, see when you listen to a clip like this is this great shot of when Walter first sees Phyllis, Barbara Stanwyck, and Fred McMurray at the top of the staircase with her little anklet on her ankle and this great shot of her legs. And so it's just so charged. And yet it's so also, I think, very humorous at the same time. And I think deliberately so, that kind of mix of darkness and seriousness.
Well, and I wonder too, do we know if that reflected how people really talk? Could people extend their metaphors that long and remain snappy? I certainly
hope so.
Frank.
Because I have been trying my entire life to talk like that with certainly limited success.
Well, actually, I think that's one of the really interesting things about about film noir in general is that there's almost this whole patois that is developed kind of in these films over the course of time that is so distinct and so otherworldly. And it's something that some of the neo-noirs that have come out in the past 20 years kind of create their own language. Brick, I'm thinking of in particular, right. A film from a few years back that takes place in a high school. It employs not language that would have been used in the 1940s, but contemporary slang used to this high poetic effect.
Well, that's the thing. It's the snappiness. It's the rapid-fire quality of it. And, of course, that's what you try to imitate when you do the satires. That's
right.
You just make it go fast. But what does it reflect about? Generally, you would think a film like this, these kind of films reflect some sort of anxiety. And it seems to me to be the performance of maleness, what men are expected to do and how smart and in control they are. I mean, is that part of what's going on here, do you think?
Certainly that is true. And as well, Frank McMurray is kind of a sap. I mean, he's kind of a weakling character. And just because he's good with the wisecrack doesn't give him a backbone, although he would like to think that it were so.
Yeah, I mean, he's manipulated, into killing this woman's husband who she doesn't want anymore, and to, get her the insurance money. So this is about men being controlled by women who know exactly what they're doing and how to get what they want.
We're doing movies on the radio today on The State of Things. Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon are with me. And Laura, a film that you chose is one that shares your name. Tell us about Laura.
Laura is a movie that starts out with the leading character, Laura, murdered. She's played by the incredibly gorgeous Jean Tierney, which is why there are many, many girls my age that were named Laura. Not because she was a murder victim, but because she was so beautiful. And the score from this movie became so pervasive in the many, many permutations. You still hear it on Muzak, in the grocery store all the time. And whenever I'm in the grocery store and I do hear the theme from Laura, I think that's an indication I should buy whatever I'm standing in front of.
Wow.
Here's a clip.
I shall never forget the weekend Laura died. A silver sun burned through the sky like a huge magnifying glass. It was the hottest Sunday in my recollection. I felt as if I were the only human being left in New York. For with Laura's horrible death, I was alone. I, Waldo Lydecker, was the only one who really knew her. And I had just begun to write Laura's story when another of those detectives came to see me. I had him wait. I could watch him through the half-open door. I noted that his attention was fixed upon my clock. There was only one other in existence, and that was in Laura's apartment, in the very room where she was murdered.
Laura. Now, is it a giant magnifying glass that you think you want to buy when you're in the supermarket? Great metaphor there.
And, of course, that's the voice of Clifton Webb, who was primarily a stage actor, making what was essentially his film debut as Waldo Lydecker, Laura's friend and confidant. And this definitely has the many of the early film noir indicators. It has the sinister score by David Raxon. It has the voiceover narration that's so important. And it has the very troubled leading man, Dana Andrews, playing a detective who essentially falls in love with a dead girl. And he does seem like one of those post-traumatic ex-military guys, because one of the things about seeing all of these films is it's hard to visualize that virtually every young man in America had been trained how to kill at this point. And they had guns that they had used in World War II. And bringing that sort of latent violence back to American society is another thing that really propels film noir.
Yeah, and I'm glad Laura brought up the idea of first person, that kind of voiceover narration, because that is one of the predominant ways that these stories get told, and often by narrators that we have to question their reliability because there's so much deception going on.
Oh, I love an unreliable narrator.
No, nothing better. Nothing better.
Was this the start of the unreliable narrator in film? Because it really does. You question your consciousness. You question your ability to believe.
I'm not sure it was the very first film that used an unreliable narrator.
But it's a big part of these films.
Yeah, it's a key part of these films. And it is part of this universe of kind of distrust and deception that it just is the prevailing sentiment.
Because you want to identify with the person who's telling the story. I mean, that's a normal reaction.
And there's a big shift between, you know, something like Double Indemnity, you know, where the voiceover first person is from the perspective of, you know, somebody who's the detective and trying to figure out what's going on, even though it's in the context of insurance. And so it's very different than the ones where the criminal is the voiceover.
On the State of Things Today, Movies on the Radio, Marcia Gordon, Laura Boies. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Films and movies on the radio. Film noir is the subject today. Marcia Gordon is a film professor at NC State University. Laura Boies, film curator at North Carolina's Museum of Art. Women play an important role in these films and their relationship with men, certainly. Talk about the way women are characterized in these films, Marcia.
Yeah, well, I mean, the femme fatale is always bad and always going to destroy the man who falls into her wicked web. One of the interesting other relationships is between the women of film noir and their children when they have children. And needless to say, perhaps, it's usually not a very positive relationship. And certainly there are some films where, in fact, it is almost at the level of horror, the mm-hmm. relationship between women and their children.
Well, that's certainly true in Mildred Pierce, because she has the most ungrateful daughter in perhaps all of movie history.
It's true.
Want to hear how bad that is? Let's listen.
This is Sylvia Feisenberger, and I'm in Durham. I think Mildred Pierce is one of my favorites because it's kind of a hybrid between film noir and melodrama. So you get this strong female character on the one hand. I think it's Joan Crawford at her most appealing. At the same time, you get the crime mystery that's told in flashback with this great performance by Anne Blythe as the sort of more typically film noir female sociopath. So I think it's a very unusual film in the sense that it's really about the relationship between the two women.
All right, Vita, from now on, things are going to be different.
I'll say they're going to be different. Why do you think I went to all this trouble? Why do you think I want money so badly?
All right, why?
Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
Then I'll tell you. With this money, I can get away from you.
Vita.
From you and your chickens and your pies and your kitchens and everything that smells of grease. I can get away from this shack with its cheap furniture and this town and its dollar days and its women that wear uniforms and its men that wear overalls.
Vita, I think I'm really seeing you for the first time in my life, and you're cheap and horrible.
You think just because you made a little money, you can get a new hairdo and some expensive clothes and turn yourself into a lady. But you can't. Because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing. With this money, I can get away from every rotten, stinking thing that makes me think of this place or you.
Vita!
Not on your life!
I said give it to me! Get out, Vita. Get your things out of this house right now before I throw them into the street and you with them. Get out before I kill you.
There's a clip from Mildred Pierce, one of the noir films that we're investigating today on The State of Things. Laura, tell us more about that film.
Well, first, I'd like to give a shout out to some of the authors of the hard-boiled literature that these came from. James M. Cain, who wrote Mildred Pierce, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, all of these people are the founding fathers of film noir. Mildred Pierce, I'd also like to mention this version, of course, is superb, but the recent HBO version with Kate Winslet, Guy Pearce, and Evan Rachel Wood from Raleigh is really excellent, and it's done in broad daylight, but is just as horrifying.
Well, and let me add to that, I'm really glad Laura brought up the authors, because they are really in part to credit and to blame for this dark material. And as a matter of fact, some of these novels were so sordid when they came out that, like, Joseph Breen, who headed up the Production Code Administration in Hollywood, said no more James Cain adaptations. And it took from 1941 to 1945 in order to even allow them to make this film.
And it's the same. Another one that's we don't have a clip from is The Postman Always Rings Twice, right, which I'm going to be showing at the museum in November. And I just reread the novel while I was writing
such
my film notes.
Novel.
And it is frightening in its juxtaposition of violence and eroticism. And it's no wonder that it took such a long time to make it to the screen.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about Mildred Pierce is here is this woman, Joan Crawford Mildred, who is so hardworking and so ambitious and trying to do all the right things.
In the Depression era model of self-reliance.
Yes. And I mean, this daughter of hers, needless to say, if you're looking for a Mother's Day film, this is a doozy. And she is this materialistic monster, you know, who she basically has to kick out of the house and who keeps coming back to haunt her in various ways. And so it's very punishing about that idea of an ambitious, driven woman, because Mildred does not have a very good life.
Are ambitious women not still being punished for not being perfect mothers? I mean, some things never change.
Right.
Well, and then the other side of that is those not perfect mothers who were more glamorized and glorified in these films in some ways, and the relationship between the femme fatale and the detective. Does that suggest a kind of an anxiety about these changing roles? Who's in charge here? Men come back, but they've got these industrial jobs. They don't require the kind of manliness that, you know, banging a brute in the head and bringing home the meat required. I mean, I don't know how much of that's a part of what's going on in this post-war period.
I think it's a really big part of it. And a lot of what you see in these films is a real fear of women's sexuality.
Right.
And it shows up over and over again.
Yeah, and independence. I mean, that these are women who can support themselves and figure out ways to have their husbands murdered. I mean,
So what do you need a guy for? You know, if you can start your own business.
And if he's going to produce children
like
Mildred's.
That horrible Vita.
Well, the snappy banner, too, it's a way for a guy to win, right? I mean, some kind of little fight that goes on.
Right.
And it's all, you know, and he doesn't have to hit anybody, although they did that, too.
Right.
Let's listen to this next pick, a small budget and a bare bones flick at that. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is David Bellerath. I live in Durham. And one of my favorite film noirs is Edgar Ulmer's Detour, which is a remarkably nasty, brutish, and short film made in the summer of 1945, which was a time when everyone was supposed to be celebrating the end of World War II. And then this incredibly bleak movie was made. And this is a really cheaply made movie about cheap characters, low-life desperation, the illusion that things will be better by moving to Los Angeles.
Well, I'm waiting.
My goose was cooked. She had me. That Haskell guy wasn't dead yet. He wasn't stretched out stiff and cold in any Arizona gully. He was sitting right there in the car, laughing like mad while he haunted me.
Well?
There was nothing I could say. It was her move. Vera, whatever her name was. It was just my luck picking her up on the road. It couldn't have been Helen or Mary or Evelyn or Ruth. It had to be the very last person I should ever have met. That's life. Whichever way you turn, fate sticks out a foot to trip you.
There it is, a clip from the film Detour, one of David's favorite film noir on The State of Things today. Laura, tell it. What did many people see that film?
I don't think many people did in its original release, but it certainly has been a staple of all the film noir revivals over the years.
It's become a real cult film. And as David points out, I mean, this is like a 70 minutes, barely a feature film, made really cheaply, but really innovative with its limited budget. And, you know, you have this, again, awful woman who just completely ruins this man's life and this future. You have terrible bad luck. I mean, that thematic of just very unfortunate, random things happening to a character. And you also have very, very common to film noir is you have terribly unhappy endings. I mean, these are not you walk out of the theater and you feel this catharsis of joy from what you've seen.
Only that your life is better than what you've just seen.
Right.
What were the critics making of all of this, especially this the sort of ambiguous moral themes or moral statement by the film itself about where you should come down? You know, were they widely criticized? Certainly they were becoming popular, but...
Well, I always like to read Bosley Crowther in the New York Times because, I mean, he's kind of a great curmudgeon of the period.
A stuffy uncle.
Yeah, exactly. And he often kind of begrudged the morality and, you know, this is so tawdry and unseemly. And so I think obviously it really depends upon who the critic was. But I think there was a lot of concern about some of the ideas that were circulating in these films and the idea of how they were representing American culture. Because let's not forget, we've always been concerned about how our movies somehow reflect as if they're just mirrors showing like documentary style what's happening in the culture. Needless to say, if you took these films as a representation of that, it would not be a very good one.
Well, and also it documents, you know, the surrealist idea of l'amour fou, the crazy love in which the goal is not marriage, home, and children, but just this kind of sexual roller coaster that people get on and they ride it to the end.
It is interesting to think about this period because it does extend into the 1950s,
yes.
Right? In television, we're getting a very different morality, a very different view of American life. It is suburban, it has white picket fences, and even if it has single dads, you know, there's a lot of virtue in how they're raising their family. Was this sort of a deliberate disconnect? I mean, the American public clearly liked film noir. They were going to see these films. What happened in TV?
Well, television is run by advertisers, and it certainly doesn't sell more toothpaste to see somebody picking up some sexy hitchhiker that leads him to murder.
Also, I mean, I don't want to give the false impression that film noir is the only film being made at the right. time. I mean, there's lots of other films, including, you know, all kinds of happy...
sappy.
Yeah, you know, films
musicals,
of all sorts.
Musicals, for instance.
Not always happy and sappy. Our listeners know that.
All right, well, Killer, that ain't musical and that ain't happy or sappy. It's a 1946 film, and let's listen to one of our listeners' take on that film.
Hi, my name is Sean Moore. I'm from Apex, North Carolina. The film I've chosen is called The Killers from 1946. This film has all the key noir elements. It's got the good guy gone bad, mainly influenced by the femme fatale, and he's associated with career criminals who are going to do a heist. In black and white, which of course is great for noir. It's the night scenes with lots of puddles and wetness and everything. And then half the film basically is in flashback, you know, with kind of narrations by the characters who are recalling the history with the main character. The film grabs you from the start. It's actually structured the same as Citizen Kane, where the main character dies at the beginning and, you know, basically pulls the audience in and says, okay, this guy died and why did he die? The thing I really like about it is Burt Lancaster gives probably the quintessential quote from a central character, the good guy gone bad in film noir.
Sweet. I was over at Henry's. A couple of guys came in and tied up me and the cook. They shoved us in the kitchen. They said they were going to shoot you when you came in to supper. Well, George thought I ought to come over and tell you.
There's nothing I can do about it.
I can tell you what they look like.
I don't want to know what they're like. Thanks for coming.
Don't you want me to go and see the police?
No, that wouldn't do any good.
Isn't there something I could do?
There ain't anything to do.
Couldn't you get out of town?
No, I'm through with all that running around.
Why do they want to kill you?
I did something wrong, once.
And that's basically the key to every film noir film, is that you've got a good guy who's made a bad choice, and he's gotten himself in a dilemma he can't get out of.
There's Sean who talks about one of his favorite films, The Killers. Marcia, tell us more about the film.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of the many film noirs about the past, basically catching up with you out of the past. With Robert Mitchum is one of the other great films that follow this line. And I think just when you think about, well, why is that? Why are all of these films so concerned with this idea and told in this kind of flashback way? And, you know, your fate is already sealed at the beginning of the film. It is so different from the kind of brand of American optimism where you can make a mistake and then you can start all over again and everything will be fine. And so I think this also reflects this sense of a kind of an inability to transcend circumstances in a way that is much more cynical than other films being made at the time that still allowed for that kind of permissiveness of reinvention.
And just listening to that dialogue excerpted out, is very existentialist. It's like, you know, circumstances are going to happen. You're powerless. And that's certainly how many people felt during World War II. You talk about an overwhelming event over which you had no power, and there was nothing that you could do to affect the outcome individually in a way.
And I think a lot of these writers are thinking about Camus, and they're thinking about Freud, and they are thinking about these philosophies of life and experience and your past haunting you and what is the meaning of things. And so it gets distilled into this pop cultural form, but that's not to say that there's not some kind of serious consideration under it.
No, and I suspect the reason that it appealed to a popular audience was so many, particularly men, were coming back with past that they couldn't quite talk about. Remember, this is World War II we're talking about, so that the kinds of therapy and the sort of openness we had to talking about your experience wasn't there. So people with a past who had who couldn't talk about it any other way.
And, you know, we call it post-traumatic stress now. In the World War II era, they called it battle fatigue. And it was something that, you know, many of us who had older relations, some people talked about their war experiences and some people just did not.
And I think something else that you can hear in all of these clips, and my students often remark on this when I show them film noir, the pacing is phenomenal. I mean, compared to other films of the period, the pacing, the dialogue delivery, the way that that events happen is so much faster than other films of the time period. So in that way, it has a very contemporary sensibility. And I think it's one of the reasons that people, you know, go to the Museum of Art to see these films, because they're so riveting.
Certainly, film noir is a period kind of genre. But is there anything along the lines of what you just said, Marcia, techniques that carried over in the cinematography, in the light, and the pacing and the writing that have carried over?
Well, I would go back a little bit, which is the influences. So, you know, thinking about something like German Expressionism, a lot of German emigres, you know, that came to the United States because of the rise of fascism ended up working in the Hollywood studios. And so that kind of intense lighting and expressionistic elements of set design all come into play. People talk, you know, consider a lot about Italian neorealism and the way that those films were looking for kind of a more, aesthetic reality, and the way that film noir reflected some of those inheritances. So I think those are things that really contributed to the look and style of film noir.
We're showing movies on the radio today on The State of Things. Marcia Gordon is with me, as is Laura Boies. And anything about the technique of this genre that struck you, Laura?
Well, one thing that I'll bring up in association with The Killers is that there are many long excerpts from this film that are used in Steve Martin's great pastiche, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, which it may be his masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. And the way he utilizes clips from film noir to create a comic story for himself, even at a certain point, dressing like Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity. And actually, he was dressed by Edith Head. It was her last film, and she had originally dressed Barbara Stanwyck for Double Indemnity. So there's a really interesting link to film noir. But it's a review of all of the film noir techniques in a comic setting that's really worth seeing.
Well, crime and moral ambiguity are big themes that we have talked about so far, and this, I think, is probably synthesized pretty well in The Third Man.
I'm Neil Morris of Peekway Arena, North Carolina, and one of my favorite films noir is The Third Man, directed by Carol Reed and written by Graham Greene. It's one of the most acclaimed examples of film noir, full of film techniques common to the genre, including Dutch camera angles and its use of lighting and shadows. The film is set and shot on location in 1949 Vienna, which is thematically significant. To American audience, the film is a twisty thriller about friendship, love, and betrayal. To European viewers, the film captured a post-World War II border city where indigenous culture and economic norms have been destroyed, leaving a void filled by outside, often unsavory opportunists. It's a cynical landscape capped by one of the film's most memorable scenes and one of the best scenes in film noir history, a gripping conversation atop the Wiener Riesenrad between protagonist Holly Martins, played by Joseph Cotten, and his former friend Harry Lime, an amoral white-collar gangster played brilliantly and quite subversively by Orson Welles.
You ought to leave this thing alone.
Have you ever seen any of your victims?
You know, I never feel comfortable in these sort of things. Victims. Don't be melodramatic.
Look down there. Would you really feel any pity if one of those dots stopped moving forever? If I offered you £20,000 for every dot that stopped, would you really, old man, tell me to keep my money? Or would you calculate how many dots you could afford to spend? Free of income tax, old man. Free of income tax. The only way you can save money nowadays.
A lot of good your money will do you in jail.
That jail's in another zone. There's no proof against me. Besides you.
There we go. Clip from The Third Man.
And he's a black marketer in penicillin. So when he talks about people dying, I mean, he's talking about, you know, children.
Yeah, there's lots of different levels of twisted morality in film noir, and this is a perfect example. The other thing I want to bring up with this film is the score, the Anton Kara score, which is so incredible. And I mean, I was about to hum it, but I've decided not to humiliate myself on air this time. But it is such a memorable score. And so many of these films, as Laura pointed out, have entered the kind of culture, whether it's in elevator music or it's just instantly recognizable, because the scores were so wonderfully done. And their part, they're not talked about as often in relationship to film noir. There's so much emphasis on the visual, but it is certainly a major part.
Well, the score is played on a zither.
Yes.
And it's very cheerful. So the happy score acts as a counterpoint to the truly desperate, desperate people in post-war Vienna. And I should say, too, Orson Welles, I believe, wrote his own dialogue for this film. It was directed by Carol Reed, although some people have given him credit for directing it, which is not true. But he did write his dialogue, especially in that scene.
We're showing movies on the radio today with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies, and our program will continue in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, movies on the radio, talking about film noir. And joining me are film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. And before the break, we were talking about film noir in the 40s. The trend, of course, continued into the 1950s. One listener chose In a Lonely Place. Let's listen.
My name is Lisa Ruckdeschel, and I live in Chapel Hill. One of my favorite film noir films is In a Lonely Place, that stars Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham. Bogey plays a very complex character. He's a struggling screenwriter and brooding, cynical, and prone to violence. And he becomes a murder suspect and is given an alibi by his neighbor, played by Gloria Graham. And they start to get together and fall in love. But Bogey's actions are unusual, and Gloria Graham becomes a bit afraid of him and doesn't know what to make of him. And one thing that's done really well in the film is that the tension builds and you wonder, did he kill the woman he's accused of murdering, or didn't he? Will he harm Gloria Graham in some way?
I was born when she kissed me. I died when she left me. I lived a few weeks while she loved me. You like it?
What is it?
I want to put it in the script. I don't know quite where.
The farewell note?
I don't know. Maybe. Say it back to me. Let's hear how it sounds.
I was born when she kissed me. I died when she left me.
I lived a few weeks while she loved me.
There we go. A clip from In a Lonely Place.
Yeah, this, I love this film. This is Nicholas Ray, and Nicholas Ray made a series of films in this period that are very much about alienation, and especially about men who are always on the verge of becoming unhinged. And I like the variations that happen in this film. I mean, Gloria Graham's character, I mean, she's a good woman, and she's very tender, and she really wants to have this relationship with Dix Steele, who played by Humphrey Bogart, but he is constantly crossing this line, and so in that way, he is the the destructive, imploding force in this film. So it really does kind of reverse some of the conventions of film noir.
Because he is a person that has some serious anger management issues.
And post-war.
And post-war, which you see again over and over again in these films, that this rage bubbles up. And in the circumstances, you're encouraged not to control your rage. But once you're integrating back into society, that sort of control is vital.
And the other thing that I think is really interesting about this film, and the listener who talked about it was, I think, very attuned to this, is that bouncing back and forth between thinking Dix is guilty, thinking he's innocent, seeing him try to control himself and be, you know, a good person and do nice things for people around him, and then becoming completely unhinged and not able to control himself. And so that tension between being normal and being deviant and maybe even psychopathic is, I think, very reflective of all of these kinds of anxieties that we have been talking about that underpin film noir.
Well, and the film is ingenious in the many ways it continues to point to that and forces you to question your own judgment. Just in that scene, we hear Humphrey Bogart using purple prose that might be coming from him, and yet it's a script, and he'd like to put it in his film, but oh, is he speaking these words to the woman? And so the idea of being alienated from your own feelings, am I reading a script, or is this how I feel? Let's hear the words in your mouth, now
right,
let's hear them in my mouth.
That's exactly right. He's trying to put words in her mouth at a time when she's perhaps having some doubts. And Gloria Graham is a wonderful, sometimes underrated actress who plays sort of femme fatale character sometimes, but she has such a beautiful vulnerability to her. I love her in The Big Heat with Glenn Ford. She's just utterly fantastic.
She's got a great voice, too.
Yeah, great voice.
Vulnerability. Is this the first time, or perhaps in the most robust way for the period, that we see vulnerability in male characters, the flawed detective, etc.?
Oh, we see that over and over again. And of course, there have always been vulnerable male characters on screen, you know, popping up here and there. But I think you do see it in a most concentrated way in film noir.
And as detectives, I mean, in a crime, I mean, you can have a love story where a man can be, but here's a case where we really expect the guy to just have it all. He's invulnerable, and yet not in these films.
And to have no question about right and wrong and be able to direct the audience toward that moral resolution that we yearn for.
And male characters aren't usually the vulnerable ones in love stories from this period. They're the ones seducing and orchestrating the romance. It's not about their vulnerability. It's about their ability to create this union that they want.
And put words in other people's mouths. Marcia, can you, what about your pick? Tell us about your pick.
Okay, so I really wanted to pick one of my favorite film noirs. It's one that not as many people have seen. It's called The Hitchhiker from 1953. And it's very notable that this is directed by a woman, Ida Lupino, one of only two women actively working in Hollywood between the 1930s and the 1960s. And this is an extraordinary, wonderful, tense little film, and it's independently made, so it is also unique in that way. It's not made for a major studio, and there's not a single woman in this film.
Let's listen.
Go ahead. Not bad. Collins! Pick up the can! Take it out of that point there. If you don't, I'll let Bowen have it. Out of the point, that's right. Further! Now hold it up! You won't get hurt. Your buddy's good with guns.
You're crazy. I won't do it.
It's just a game. Go ahead. Collins, hold it closer to you. What's the matter? You scared? Hold it closer. You want me to try it again? I might miss this time.
A little bit of The Hitchhiker, yeah.
Yeah, Marcia? So this is what you're hearing is the psychotic hitchhiker that these men have picked up when they're getting away from their wives for a weekend, notably. And he kidnaps them, and he proceeds to basically torture them in all of these different ways and makes them so submissive and so vulnerable, and they have no control over their fate. And so it's those themes revisited, but in this very kind of constricted, a lot of time in the car and a lot of time being told what to do and do this and go there and get that. And it's a very intense exploration of these kind of male relationships.
And it's interesting that two of the films that we're talking about have Picking Up the Wrong Hitchhiker,
yep.
At a time when hitchhiking was legal because the GIs came back to the U.S. and they were let off, you know, wherever they landed and then would have to hitchhike back across the country to wherever they came from. And how, you know, it's that one wrong decision that you make affects your entire life.
And, of course, one notable film, Picking Up a Hitchhiker, is, I think, demonstrates a theme that's played out over and over again, at least in the period, not always in noir films, this fear that women are somehow, you're trying to do the best you possibly can for them and you're trying to help them out, but they're so deceitful and there's something so powerful about them that even when you're trying to do the best for them.
Yeah, and that's, again, why this film is so interesting, because there is no woman. I mean, this is picking up two men who are, you know, right, who's going to mess with a man and picking and up another man who absolutely ruins their lives.
And they're asking the men to assume the submissive female.
Right.
Role. I will tell you what to do and you will do it.
How did the film do when it came out? Do we know?
It was not a big box office success. I mean, this is an independent film that, you know, had relatively limited circulation as opposed to some of the bigger box office studio films.
What do you think did in the genre? I mean, is there a date, nearly date certain toward the end of the 50s we just stopped seeing them done? For real? I mean, obviously.
No, because they keep resurfacing. I mean, that's the thing about film noir. It's really more of a style and a thematic than it is, you know, say, like calling it a genre or like saying the musical or sci-fi or something like that. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the interesting things about when you see films crop up like Blade Runner, for example, which is sci-fi and futuristic. By the way, I think it takes place in 2019, which is like 5 years from now, which seemed like a long time ago in the 1980s. But, you know, a film like that is really relying on a certain kind of aesthetic sensibility and these kind of thematic elements. So, yes, there is a decrease in the kind of intensity of production of these films, but there's also, it doesn't go away. It just keeps coming back in different forms.
Well, I actually think that color photography is one of the things that changes the whole way you look at film noir, because L.A. Confidential, for example, is a fantastic film, but it's in color, so somehow it's just not as noir-y as you want it to be. If the sun beams slanting through the blinds really are golden instead of gray, it's different somehow.
Not quite the same. And Marcia, you mentioned earlier the film Brick, and one of our listeners thought that was a fine one, too, and it's a little more contemporary.
My name is Shannon Latham from Raleigh, and I'm addicted to film noir. My favorite film is Rian Johnson's 2005 neo-noir thriller Brick. The film is about a high school crime ring in Southern California, and our hard-boiled hero is a teenage loner named Brendan, who's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he's on the trail of finding his ex-girlfriend's murderer. One of the most distinctive aspects of this gritty and beautiful film is the dialogue, which is like directly snatched from Dashiell Hammett's style of writing. For example, Brendan threatens a local delinquent and his gang behind a pastry store, and he says,
"Quilling at me if you want, Hashhead. I got all five senses, and I slept last night. That puts me six up on the lot of you."
There we go. That's a good line. I'm using that. Yeah.
Well, another sort of neo-noir is the television series Veronica Mars, which stars Kristen Bell as a detective, a teenage detective, because her father is a detective. But it's visually shot in that film noir-y way, and she does a voiceover where she does that kind of wisecracking detective thing that makes it very appealing. And she has a similar motivation in that her best friend has been murdered, and so she is on the trail of that crime.
And I think one of the interesting things that language thing brings up, because obviously it's very artificial, and I think when you ask that question, did people really talk that way? And it's like, no, of course they didn't talk that way, because I think one of the pleasures of film noir, and I like that Shannon called herself an addict. it's okay, you don't need help. but is that there was a certain artificiality to that world. I mean, aesthetically, with all of the light and shadow, and, you know, in terms of what people did in these films, and then the way they spoke to each other in this very unnatural way that there's a different kind of escapism. It's escape to this kind of darker place, the world of nightmares as opposed to the world of dreams, but it's no less imaginative.
And I think there is a kind of dialogue in between real life and the films, because to a certain extent, criminals learned their lingo from the movies and then brought it into real life, and then their slang evolves and ends up in the movies. So it goes back and forth.
So do movies like Scarface fit into this at all, or are they pure adventure kind of dramas, do you think?
I would say Scarface, the gangster films of the 1930s, are the predecessors of film noir. I mean, if you look at them alongside these, there are certain things that are contiguous, but they're not the same at all visually. But, I mean, certainly focusing on a criminal, in that case, in the 1930s gangster films, the criminals are always both very attractive in terms of their lifestyle and their what they were able to get away with, and always punished at the end. And
well, the gangster films are the dark side of capitalism. It's the American dream gone wrong. You can't get a regular job, so you go into crime.
We're showing movies on the radio today on The State of Things. My guests are Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. We're talking about film noir, yeah, and the fact that that's really how it works. We do a little protection racket here, you know. If you want to play the game, you just
you mean a WUNC?
That's how we do it, and you get a tote bag to boot. So that's kind of cool. I wonder how much of it too has changed simply because we're less shocked by moral ambiguity and some of the doubts that are reflected in the 1940s, when, of course, I guess that's not right, because in the 1930s, a lot of those themes were already playing out in the films, weren't they?
Yeah, well, and I think actually one of the things we haven't really talked about is the influence of the Production Code Administration on all of these films, because, you know, I think I alluded earlier to the fact that there was some concern about certain writers like James Cain's novels being so sordid and tawdry. And indeed, if you read something like The Postman Always Rings Twice, when I teach that film and literature, my students are shocked at what happens in that like 96-page novel.
It's shocking.
From start to finish. Every page has something on it that, you know, you raise your eyebrows at. But so while the Production Code Administration, which oversaw the kind of moral content of film as a self-regulating body within Hollywood, was very concerned about these things, one of the things that happens, I think the screenwriting gets so clever with that innuendo. And, from when you hear the clips from like Double Indemnity and these other films where there is so much that is implied, but it is so obvious, the fact that they are skirting these censors, the self-censorship body of Hollywood, is part of the playfulness of this.
The production code also mandated things that we don't necessarily think about these days. Like, they objected to films that were a step-by-step how to commit a crime.
Right.
So you had to be very oblique about how crimes were permitted. Women's clothing was highly policed. For example, you were not allowed to have any breast movement on screen. That is something that would immediately be cut. So in Double Indemnity, Barbara Stanwyck has a very rigid foundation and a high neck, and the censors would look at it and say, oh, well, she's not sexy. So it's a matter of how you evade these limitations.
And yet, in something like Double Indemnity, I mean, there is a pretty clear representation of how they think that they're going to pull off this perfect crime. But the catch is, and this has always been one of the funny things about the production code, if you punished your criminals in the end, you know, you could get away with a lot, yeah. As long as there's the bad guys.
That's right.
And
crime,
bad girls
crime had
get
to
away.
Be punished.
Or if you could prove that the step-by-step didn't work. For instance,
right.
I have dialed M. No murder. Doesn't work. Marcia, Laura, always a pleasure. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. The museum, by the way, hosting a series of screenings featuring The Unreliable Men of Film Noir. More details at our website, stateofthings.org. And the next time we get together, we're going to talk about films made right here in the state of North Carolina, where we once had a robust film industry. We don't know about the future, but we'll talk about that on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.